Hello again, I'm Adam Shapiro, and welcome to Talkonomics. About 2 weeks ago, I got to meet a comedian, Kareth Foster, and she was a guest on a previous Talkonomics talking about a film in which she appears called Can We Take a Joke? And it's about this crackdown on free speech and political correctness on college campuses and why some comedians are boycotting college campuses or afraid to play college campuses. But as I was talking with Kareth, I realized that, I mean, let's face it, I was a product of the 1970s and 80s as a child, and I used to watch those ABC after school specials. And my perception of reality and race in the United States is based on these kind of sugary network television of the 70s when there was nothing else to watch or do, understandings of race. And so you could have these horrible stereotypes if you've ever seen a policewoman with Angie Dickinson or Beretta. There was a guy on Beretta, Sugar Bear, I think it was.
Yeah, Huggy Bear,
who was a pimp. I mean, it was – the stereotypes in that venue were awful. But then you get the after-school specials where everybody was this happy rainbow of goodness and together. So that is where I come from when I talk about race. And I approached Kareth and I said, look, I would like to have a conversation with you, which I call the uncomfortable conversation, because I think a lot of black people and white people would like to talk about issues that we're afraid to talk to with our friends because they're our friends and we don't want to upset each other. And she agreed. So she is with us right now on Talkonomics once again. Hi, Kareth.
Hello, hello. Am I?
Yeah, you can. That is how. Oh, no. You were on.
Your
mic was on.
Okay.
She just pushed the button so that if you want to cough.
Now I hear me. Volume. There you go. See, that's why I do this on stage and not in
a
studio anymore, right? The production team is what I need.
It's okay. If you need to cough, just cough. We can cut it out.
And
you might hear us drinking. It's not alcohol. It's water and coffee. You're off alcohol. In fact, let's go there before we get uncomfortable. Why are you not drinking alcohol?
No, that's uncomfortable. I am not drinking alcohol because I wanted to feel really, really good and transform my body. So I'm doing something called Whole 30, which is 30 days of no sugar, no wheat, no dairy, no gluten, no alcohol, no grains, no legumes, except for green beans and snap peas. And
you eat air. You're eating air.
Yeah, eggs and air.
Oh, it must be real pleasant in the morning in your household.
I have toddlers, so I cannot tell you how much a glass of wine would. My husband and I, we joke that we used to think people who drank before 4 o'clock were alcoholics. And now we know they're just parents.
So. I worked with a man in Cleveland named Don Edwards. He was the weatherman. He hosted this back in the 60s. It was kind of an American Bandstand.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was called Upbeat. And it's in syndication still. They would have – the Rolling Stones would come through Cleveland, the whole thing. He enjoyed life. That's how I'll say it. And he used to – every day he would leave after the 6 o'clock news. He'd come back for the 11 o'clock. He'd do the weather, and he was always in a good mood. And he used to say the problem with America and the United States is we got rid of the 3-martini lunch.
So, probably the drunk driving had a little something to do with that,
that
too.
Might have had something to do with
it. The DUI.
Yeah, but in a city like New York, we take the subway, which doesn't work
anyway.
Well,
there anyway, you go. So. Exactly. Right. New York, you can do it.
So first, before we get uncomfortable, and it may not be that uncomfortable, but let me ask you this. What is it like to be an over 35-year-old brown woman? You refer to yourself as brown, not black, in America in 2016.
Well, I mean, I obviously, census-wise, I identify as black. African-American, if that's the label people like. I can't trace myself back to Africa without a genetic test. I can trace myself to the Virgin Islands. I can trace myself to England and to Denmark and to America with Native Americans. So I was never asked what I was, though, until I moved to New York. I grew up in Texas, and it was, you know, you're black, you're brown, you're yellow, you're white. And I got to New York, and people were like, what are you? And I'm like, what do you mean? I didn't know what they meant. And they were like, are you Dominican? Are you, you know, are you Somali? Like, what are you? And I had to start identifying myself in a new way. And, you know, I grew up in a very interesting environment. We were one of very few black families in a nearly all-white suburb of Plano, Texas. I often joke about, you know, growing up in a place that had the ethnic diversity of a Klan rally. And there were things that were normal for me that I didn't realize might not be so normal for other people. Like, might actually being in an all-white production of the play A Raisin in the Sun. Like, that was my reality.
An all-white at that time.
And, you know, I joke. I'm like, yeah. Two guesses on who the raisin was. But that was my life. And I didn't know anything else. And so, for me, I knew I wasn't white. I never thought I was white. I never wanted to be white. But it was very difficult figuring out my identity. My parents did a wonderful job. I mean, I learned about my heritage, and I was involved in certain organizations like Jack and Jill, which is a fantastic organization that goes back, gosh, almost, you know, well, decades. My father was in it. And it's an organization for African-American families to associate with one another. And typically they're of an upper echelon, a upper middle class. So that they can associate with one another. Because typically, we do get separated when we go to the suburbs and we're in environments like I was raised in.
Well, you refer to part of your family as the Huxtables.
Yes.
Because part
yes.
of your family is the Huxtables and the other
right.
part of the family
well,
is...
Well, we married into the other part.
We all have that side of the family.
They're the brown honey boo-boos.
Yes.
they're kind of the ghetto fabulous. Huh. And, you know, but, you know, for... It's so interesting. I've been having so many revelations personally now that I am the mother of biracial children. Mm-hmm. And just seeing just what is happening with race and the discussions of it in this country. You know, for a long time, I was probably one of those people who thought, like many white people, why can't black people just, you know, get it together? Don't you understand that if you speak a certain way and act a certain way, you won't have as many problems? But what I've really come to realize after a lot of self-examination is that a lot of my privilege that I have mm-hmm. actually stems from white privilege.
Okay, so you've just there's so much I wanted to ask you about. You just hit one term, white privilege. You should know last week we had Jason Riley on, who wrote the book Please Stop Helping Us, How Liberal Policies Hurt Black Americans. Mm-hmm. And he actually makes the argument that, look, speaking the way people speak, speaking proper English is important. You even joke about your cousin DeGeneres.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, DeGeneres.
And you said, what does that mean? That means I never want to get a job in corporate America. I'm not saying it's right that when these resumes come across that there's a predisposition to say I'm going to go with Sarah over DeGeneres just based on a name and not on qualifications. But that happens.
Absolutely.
And what he would say is, the society, names like John or Sarah or Maria, I grew up with, my first friend in this world was Maria Smith. We went to Cocoa Plum Elementary and kindergarten together. And her mother is Diane Smith, married to Ernest Gaines, the author. Mm-hmm. My mother, Brenda Bernstein Shapiro, I'm Shapiro, but she's Shapiro. They used to do something in the 60s. And my mom talks about this. My mom would call up landlords and say they were on the panel of American Women together. And Brenda Bernstein would call up and say, I want to come see an apartment. And my name is Brenda Bernstein. And then Diane Smith would go to mm-hmm. see the apartment mm-hmm. and she's black. And they'd say, oh, it's been rented.
You just touched on something. My parents were married in 1967. My father was in the Air Force mm-hmm. And he was stationed out in Great Falls, Montana, where it was not very diverse at all. And there wasn't even a lot going on. I mean, I think the speed limit said reasonable on the signs there. Seriously.
And suggested.
Their first year of marriage, my mom went out there with him, too, because mm-hmm. they were married. They drove cross-country. And every time – there wasn't enough room on the base at the time. Every time they went to see an apartment, they'd called up for. As soon as they arrived, they were told it had been rented. So the first year of their marriage, my dad had to put my mom on a plane and send her back home. They could not live together the first year that my parents were married because no one would rent to them.
Okay, so that was what we've just talked about, the 60s and 70s. Do you think that still goes on today?
I do. I do believe it still happens. I think it happens a little more subtly. You know, although I'm sure those experiences, you know, happen. I think sometimes people get charged more if mm-hmm. they're of a minority. I think that, you know, for some reason we have this division mindset. We have this separation mindset in this country. And that's one of the things that I'm trying to do with my comedy. And, you know, I obviously, comedy is, you know, you get on stage, you tell jokes, but I think it's deeper than that. I think comedy is a tool to help people recognize what similarities we have. I think it is something that can be used as a universal tool to create understanding and education and even bonding.
So let me ask you, because you also brought up the term white privilege. Mm-hmm. And I'm white, mm-hmm. and I hear that term and I seize up. And Ben Shapiro, who's been a guest on Talkonomics, talks about white privilege, and people who use that term use it to silence discussion. The minute you accuse someone of white privilege, you're essentially saying, he says, to shut them up.
I hate that.
And I would say, you know, what white privilege, for instance, with Jason Riley, we talked about here in the New York City school systems, there's a discussion about the enrollment in the premier schools, you know, mm-hmm. Bronx Science, mm-hmm, that kind mm-hmm. of thing, and how there are more white students in the schools than black students, but there are more Asian students than white students. So is there Asian privilege? That's what people who have trouble with that term white privilege would say. What would you say to them?
Well, okay. My definition of white privilege may be a little more skewed from that. When I think of white privilege, I think of going to the store with my daughter, right, and her seeing a hairbrush, and it says for normal hair. And it has a picture of a white woman on it with silky hair. Why is that normal hair? Why isn't her curly hair normal? Are my hair normal? That's white privilege. The white privilege is being able to go anywhere and turn on the TV and see images of yourself. You know, my child recently said something, and, you know, we watched some Disney, we watched some Nickelodeon, and I am so conscious of it now. How many of the characters look like my kid? How many characters look like someone she can associate with? And it's staggering how few. You know, every now and then there's like a token, you know, beige person on there. But I think about, you know, that study they did, back in the 70s. Have you ever seen the video of, it's a little African-American
girl
with the dolls, right?
What's
the good doll? What's the bad doll? And that's part of white privilege. Seeing yourself so much that you think that you're normal and you're right and you're good versus the negative images that you see of someone else.
When you talk about the negative images, though, let's talk about some of the rap music. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's this one song, My Neck, My Back, and I can't say the rest of it. But you know the song? It's a hip-hop song. Huge hip-hop song. There's a comedian on YouTube who does a version of it. He's a white guy, and he sings it like he's a 1950s, I think it's Richard Cleese.
Cheese or something like that.
You know, look it up on YouTube. We can't discuss it because it is. Right. But he does it as a 50s lounge act. It's a riot. But, you know, when you talk – if a positive image is reinforcing for a person's identity, how come we can't have a discussion, or can we, about negative rap images?
We should have a discussion about it. And, in fact, it is a big deal in the black community. You know, there are a lot of African Americans and black people who are like, this is harming us. Do you understand? This is hurting us. This is hurting how we perceive ourselves. This is hurting how we are perceived in the world to others. But it also is – it goes back to freedom of expression. Are people allowed to express themselves? And what's really interesting for me is I find how much of the popular culture, pop culture, is actually taken from gay culture and mm-hmm. from black culture. Like the lingo and the words and the colloquialisms, it's fascinating to me. I mean, when I heard Katie Couric years ago say bling, I was like, really? Yeah. You know? So where did that come from?
Well, it's part of the Jewish conspiracy. It's how we keep everyone in control. I'm part of ZOG, the Zionist Occupation Government. So, but when I ask you about that, there's mm-hmm. an incident right now. We talked in the last discussion when you were here to talk about the film, mm-hmm. Can We Take a Joke, about social media. I'm going to use the term social media lynch mobs mm-hmm. because there were some kids at a private school in Brentwood, California, who apparently were rapping a song and they used the N-word. Mm-hmm. And none of these kids are black. Mm-hmm. And now there's outrage about this. And are these kids racist, or are these kids repeating what, you know, a hip hop song that they love? Because if I were to walk down the street singing My Neck, My Back mm-hmm. and go to the rest of it, I think people would look at me as, who's that crazy middle-aged white guy? But I don't know if they would call me racist.
No.
What about these kids? I don't think
they were being racist either.
That's what people are saying.
I think racist is when you are intentionally using those words for hate and to hold power over someone else. That, to me, is what racism is about. It's unfortunate that there are instances like that where, you know, people want to pull a race card when there's so many more legitimate things, like people being overcharged for living places mm-hmm. or for, you know, where their supermarkets are. They're being charged more than a wealthier white neighborhood. That, to me, is racist, you know, more than words. And while words are powerful, and I absolutely 110% believe that, you also have to look at context.
Okay, but let's also look at, you brought up the hairbrush mm-hmm. with normal hair. Is it possible that the manufacturer in marketing that brush is going to where they're going to make the most money, which is just the majority right now of the population, might be still Caucasian. I mean, even
okay. Well, that hairbrush was in Harlem. This is the Duane Reade in Harlem. So, well,
but the other it's a good point. But the other issue has to do with when we talk about Harlem. You hear a discussion in our city that there aren't the same kind of supermarkets mm-hmm. and food stores mm-hmm. and. Wouldn't it make sense? I don't know if I'm going off. Well, it's an uncomfortable discussion. Why hasn't an entrepreneur who might be black or white opened up the kind of store to service that neighborhood?
That's a really great question.
Why is it racism that keeps that out?
Well, I don't know that there hasn't been an opportunity or people trying to do that. I know next door to me there is a wine store owned initially by African Americans. They sold it, and now a Hispanic gentleman owns it. I think there are a lot more opportunities now mm-hmm. for black entrepreneurs to do things. But there's still a process of going to get loans, getting investors, all of those things. And I read an article recently about a man in Silicon Valley. I cannot recall his name to save my life, but he talked about how as a black entrepreneur, finding investors was so difficult because as soon as they met him, they just assumed that he, you know, didn't necessarily know what he was talking about. And all of his white counterparts got investors a lot faster than he did. So, you know, he's saying, I have, you know, this Ivy League education. I have a business degree, yet still there are things that are hard. And he's, you know, he's an attractive man. He's, you know, fair in complexion. But there's still this mentality of, okay, they're not quite like us. And I think that goes back to people just wanting to be comfortable. And they get freaked out when they get uncomfortable. And that's probably one of the biggest issues in this country today is when people don't know something, when they haven't been brought up with it or surrounded by it, it's uncomfortable unless they have come in with a different mindset or there's a mind shift.
Well, there can be too much. When I was an anchor in Cleveland, Ohio, I had a co-anchor, Danita Harris, who is still – she's the main anchor mm-hmm. at Channel 5 where we used to work. And she and I were like that. We were very good friends. We used to joke back and forth about all kinds of things. But she said on air one day, she's black, and she said she started the morning show, "Good morning, Cleveland. I'm Daniqua, and this is Aquan, and those are our ghetto names." And I was sitting there, and I was like, wow. And I said to her, "I don't think you can say that." She said, "I just did. It's okay." So now fast forward. I left Cleveland, and Danita and I are still – we still talk quite a bit. And I was working at WNBC, and I was in the morning makeup room, and all of these women were getting made up. I was the only guy in there. And one of them is a very popular anchor at Channel 4, still there. And she was talking with the makeup artist and everybody about, you know, what should she do with her hair? And I said, why don't you try cornrows? Oh, I just saw the look on your face. Yep,
just
that's exactly right. Right.
Next.
Right, you know where this went. I got hauled into... You know,
no.
And it was – so and in our last discussion, mm-hmm. Ted, the director of the film, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Balaker, said that intent is germane. My intent was just to make a joke.
Right.
With Danita, it would have been ha-ha, you know.
Right.
Oh, my God. You would think
– You were
that,
in HR
that,
for how many hours?
You would think I had walked in wearing a Klan outfit about to burn a cross. And I was – wow. And it was an eye-opening experience
right,
for me.
Right. Well, you cannot joke about black women's hair. That's just the first faux pas that you made. You just don't talk about black women's hair unless
they
you're
were joking
a hairdresser.
About it.
I know. But unless you're doing it and mm-hmm. your hair you – know.
Well, that's like the N-word.
Yeah.
Well, why is it okay? Why is it okay? And even in the gay community, why is it okay for gay people to refer to one another with the F-word?
Right.
Why is it okay for black people to refer to one another with the N-word? In the Jewish community, we do not use the K-word.
It's just not a term of affection. Sure. You know, I can't say that I fully understand. As a black American, I find the N-word completely offensive. And yet, in that same note, I think comedians like Cat Williams and Sherrod Small, who I'm going to introduce you to, when they use it sometimes, it's so natural coming out of their mouths mm-hmm. that – and it's so part of just who they are, and you know it's not maliciously intended – that it seems acceptable. I don't use it. I don't like it. I don't like the way it sounds. I don't like the taste it leaves in my mouth. I know where the word comes from, the history of it, and I don't approve of my – I will not use it. in any kind of context.
I did not know there was a history, and obviously there would be. Where does it come from? Can we talk about
it? Actually, I know, it actually is – you're calling someone an ignorant person, and I do believe it comes from, you know, from Africa. There was a, you know – Nigeria and Niger and all of those things, and it became a slang term.
Okay,
and you know I'm not one, so why would I call anybody else one? Why would I even associate with that?
Well, even you've heard it as we've been talking.
Mm-hmm.
I've sometimes said Black Americans. I've said African Americans. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of confused. What am I supposed to
say?
Oh
my gosh!
My nephews corrected me,
and I'm one of them. I love living in England because, you know, I was colored, but it was with a U, so.
But you can't. but okay. There was a time in this country where we would say people of color.
Yes.
And I suspect we'll get back to – I'm the white guy who used to watch Star Trek reruns.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this episode where Uhura, Nichelle Nichols – I would love to interview Nichelle Nichols.
Mm.
She's talking to Abraham Lincoln. Don't ask why Abraham Lincoln is on the Enterprise.
Emancipation Proclamation.
And he says – it's something to the effect of – Star Trek fans, don't quote me exactly, please. I'm going to butcher it. But he says essentially, what a lovely negress. And then he realizes he might have said something offensive. And Uhura says, don't worry. In our time, we've learned that words how does she say it? We don't judge ourselves by words.
Mm.
But she's not saying we're colorblind.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
She talks about accepting everybody. And this is, 1969, 1970, for who they are.
Right.
And acknowledging who they are. Because when I talk to you about that 1970s childhood experience, I think in that time it was about being colorblind.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we should be colorblind.
Absolutely.
I don't think anybody on this
planet
thinks we should
be. And I think that's what's happening with millennials today, especially when I go on college campuses and I take my programs. I have a program called Stereotypes 101 that I created. It's a humorous diversity program because I think you can't address something as serious and as deep as diversity, and I mean all diversity, without bringing some humor into it, because you've got to break down the walls, you've got to level the playing field and make people comfortable. But being colorblind is not okay, because what you're essentially saying is, I don't see that person's color, I don't see that, you know, that person's heritage. They're just like me. Well, no, they're not. They have had different experiences than you. We've all had our own experiences. We all come from our own reality, and we need to acknowledge that.
But there seems to be, when you look at the college campuses, when they have lectures or they have workshops on whiteness, there seems to be an attack on what I'll call white culture or Western culture. I mean, we live in the West.
Mm-hmm.
There's debates now about whether you should be teaching European philosophers in the United States. But we're a Western country. That educational canon is what we're about, just as I imagine in Japan they're teaching Asian philosophy, perhaps. I don't know. But when someone who's white, I would suspect, hears, I'm going to teach you about whiteness, some people seize up. Why is that appropriate, or is it not appropriate?
This is an uncomfortable conversation. I love it.
You're not
going
to offend me.
No.
You make me laugh too much.
I don't think there's anything wrong with being taught about how you see yourself, and maybe how seeing yourself as this universal figure may be incorrect. But I think that's what a lot of people have a hard time with. And I think, you know, if someone went over to Japan, right, and they lived there and they realized, you know, they were the only person that was like 6 feet tall and didn't have, you know, almond-shaped eyes and they had light color hair, they would feel like they stuck out for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how a lot of minorities feel in this country all the time. And this is their home.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I don't think people realize that. One of the things I try to get people to do is I say CARE. I created an acronym. And that means have conscious empathy. Not just, you know, empathize with, oh, you know, that's unfortunate that person came from that background. But actually truly think about what it may be like for that person who grew up a certain way, for the experiences that person had, for the images they have been shown and how that reflects on who they believe they are. You know, those are such big things that most people don't even think about.
See, I think that a lot of people, I don't know if they think about it to the degree that you have been able to put into words, but I think most people are decent. And I think most people, what we're talking about is, in my opinion, good behavior.
Oh,
it's like standing up on the subway when you have a seat for the woman who's pregnant. I mean, and those seats on the subway are worth millions when it's crowded.
Trust me, I was pregnant on a subway. I'm not disagreeing with you. I absolutely think most people are decent. I think most people agree on the same things politically. But we feel like we have to choose a side in this country where we have to stand. I think most people fall in the middle, I'll be honest. I don't believe most people are racist. I think there is a lot of unconscious bias that still happens.
The resume example.
For everyone. Yeah. For everyone. Not just white people. And that's the thing. I hate when it's this war on white people that's why I think the program that I've designed is so popular and it works so well, because it talks about how everyone has their own reality, and it's really just acknowledging that and then moving forward from that space so that the communication and the discussions can be had.
So is it appropriate for colleges to have required diversity courses, do you think? Or should those courses be voluntary?
Oh, wow. You know, I think everyone should have a course in diversity.
So you think it should be required?
I do. I think everybody. But it shouldn't be diversity where it's like you're bad for being who you are. That's not what diversity is about. Diversity is about seeing that other people have different experiences, that other people are coming from different places, and finding a place for mutual respect. It's not about hating on someone else because they got more. I mean,
well, the French. We can hate the French.
Well, maybe the French. No, but it's you know, I think that's – I actually, can I tell you? Yeah. I hate the word diversity. I think it is polarizing.
Yeah.
I think it – you know, it's almost become like the word liberal in this country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people see it as such a negative thing. I prefer the term inversity. That's something – because I think it's about being introspective. And think about how often – People don't even like themselves a lot of times. They have issues with themselves.
Oh.
How can you like someone else if you don't like yourself? It's just like loving someone. You know, how can you be in a loving relationship if you don't love yourself first?
I mean, you know, when you're talking about diversity, when I hear the term white privilege, I immediately think about, because I lived in the Midwest for a long time. I was not considered anorexic, as you joke about, you know, in the East Coast, pleasantly plump. And I had a friend who worked in a steel mill. Grew up in Bobtown, Pennsylvania. It was just on the other side of the West Virginia border, coal mine town, the whole thing. And he used to use the N-word, and he would use it to describe people who were white. And I said, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. I would say to him, you can't do that. And you would think if you met this man, as my brother once did, and my brother considers him a racist. And I said, yeah, but you have to also remember this man. We became very close friends. We're best friends, he and his wife and I. And he took, without telling me, courses in Judaism to learn more about what my world was about. So how can you call that man a racist?
Right.
I said
right.
to my brother. But the other experience I had in Cleveland, which I love, because I've gotten a couple of hate letters in my career. The best was Indianapolis, get the Jew off the air.
Oh.
Loved that one because it said, send your new star to New York. And I was a kid. You know, it was one of my first jobs. Like, yeah, I'm a star. Send me to New York. It was in 1998. I was in Cleveland. I was an anchor in Cleveland, and the Klan was going to rally in Cleveland. They had done it in Indianapolis a few years before that. So I went to interview the Grand High Poobah in Fort Wayne, the Cyclops or something. And I'm sitting down with him, and this is all on tape. And he's talking about all kinds of people, and he's talking about Jews and how Jews control the banks and the money. Mm-hmm. And I didn't challenge him. What I said was, and the whole exchange is recorded, I'm not disagreeing with you about Jews controlling the banks or the money, but you know I'm Jewish. He said, yes. And I said, can you tell me which Jews? Because I want my cut. And he looked at me like, are you crazy? And I said, I'm serious. If my people are controlling all the money, I'm not getting my share, and I want my share. And he started to laugh. And then he said, well, not all Jews.
Right.
And
right.
It was in that moment, and this was just, you know, I come from a sarcastic family. And it was in that moment that I realized you can't beat people over the head. You can't teach people to be diverse.
No.
You just got to listen to stupidity. And sometimes you have to respond to stupidity with stupidity, and maybe you can open a window. I don't know.
Right. And that's why, you know, going back to should all institutions be required to have diversity training if it's done the right way? You know, I think I come at it from a very different approach. For me, it's not forcing anyone down anybody else's throat. It's not saying you have to love these people. You have to hang out with these people all the time. You have to, you know, completely. Everyone's entitled to their own opinions, okay? There's a difference, though, between having an opinion and having a judgment. When you are judgmental, you think everybody should be the way you do, the way you are, and think the way that you do.
Now, as a product of the 70s, mm-hmm. you were talking about not seeing your daughter's face on television. Mm-hmm. And part of me says, okay, but, you know, movie studios, if they could make money. Mm-hmm. We saw this with the Oscars, and there weren't any African-American, Black Americans mm-hmm. who were nominated mm-hmm. this time around. What about the argument that, well, if you could make money, you know, marketing mm-hmm. to people, it would happen. So why aren't there studios?
But it is happening.
You
see it all the time. I mean, hello, Oprah. Like, it's like this scandal. Oprah. Look at ABC. Look at what Shonda Rhimes and
right.
Betsy Beers are
it
doing.
It is happening.
You know, Empire. Lee Daniels. I mean, look at.
Right. So you're making the argument that people who would say, no, it isn't. There are faces out there for your daughter to see. Oprah, when she was a daytime star, but not today. Yeah, but there are people who replace her.
And how many shows are there now? Right? How many?
Well, I don't watch network TV anymore.
You don't watch children's programming either.
No.
I mean, thank God for Sesame Street.
Right.
That's all I can say.
Yeah, but you
got to
pay for it now.
Sesame
it's on
Street.
HBO.
So it's, you know, it's just something I'm very conscious of.
Right.
And, you know, with my daughter, like I want her to have black and white dolls. I want her to mm-hmm. have a rainbow of dolls. I want her to have Asian dolls. I mean, we live in New York City right now. I want her to see the world around her and not have to label herself. Or put, you know, be put in a box. And I think that's why my program's called Stereotyped 101. Because we all stereotype. You know, it's something every single mm-hmm. one of us does. And I think, honestly, that goes back to just plain human nature.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, if you can identify a situation or a person, then you can feel safe about it. And that's what is running everything. Fear. Fear of the unknown. Fear of what we, you know, makes us a little uncomfortable. Fear of what we do not know yet.
I want to shift to something.
Okay.
We'll come back to uncomfortable because this is fun. But I'm curious because I love comedians. And we all grow up laughing at comedians. For me, it was a Cheech and Chong album years ago mm-hmm. with Sister Mary Elephant. Class, shut up. But what is it like first to be a female comedian? Because I know that there have been documentaries about the struggles women have being comedians. Then what's it like to be a black comedian?
Well, I think I'm an interesting case because I've always kind of approached it as I'm a comedian first. Yes, I'm black. Yes, I'm a woman. Those are bonuses. And I think a lot of that has to do with my very unique upbringing. You know, my parents, like I said, teaching me how to be proud of who I was and going to a women's college where, you know, the sky was the limit. But I have been in situations multiple times where I've been the only woman on a show. I've been the only black person on a show, and it's very interesting. Unless I was producing my own shows, there were not more women than me or more African-Americans than me or more African-American women. I tried to have I called it comedy noir, and it was just black female comics. And, you know, that lasted a little while.
Mm-hmm.
But then it was also kind of hard for me to find, you know, more of us who were at the same level who could do that show. It's a male-dominated field, comedy is, period. And there are different. Have you ever heard of the Chitlin Circuit?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's that world, mm-hmm. which I didn't quite fit into, even though I did the Apollo, mm-hmm. and I did really well at the Apollo, even though I was out ghettoed. But that's another story. So it's, you know, for me, it's been interesting. I think it's always been. Oh, it's what set me apart, but it's also been hard for me to find representation in management because I didn't fall into that category. That mm-hmm. I wasn't the sassy black girl who was rolling her neck and talking about baby daddies and getting high and all that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't Monique. I wasn't Samour. And, you know, hats off to those ladies for crafting their art and doing their thing and, you know, having those characters or even part of themselves, you know, be on stage. That's not who I was. But I also wasn't the cute little blonde girl like Amy Schumer. So people really, for a long time, have not known what to do with me. And I think that was, you know, it's been a little bit detrimental as far as moving forward. But I hope times are changing. The only thing I could ever do was be true to myself. But I think that's what led to my job with IMUS, because he needed a black person.
Was this after the comment that got him in trouble?
This was after Nappy Headed Hose, or I call it Nappy Gate.
Now, again, I was at NBC when that happened.
Were you?
And I remember thinking, wow, It was, and it was actually, I think, one of the first examples, and I'm not going to say whether it was justified or not, but of social media coming to bear down on,
mm-hmm.
that's right, because
mm-hmm.
he was out of there faster than a television reporter at Free Food.
Yeah.
I mean, it was.
It was a slow news day, and he got caught saying yeah. something he shouldn't have. And, you know, as a comedian, I understand how you can say something and not, you're trying to make a joke and it being totally misunderstood. Now, the problem with what he said was that A, it wasn't funny.
Right.
And B, what it
and those
up
kids
doing
had
was,
earned
was,
a great honor.
It was being harmful. It was harmful.
Yeah, well,
it
he was detracting from the honor that they had
right,
achieved.
Right. But there was, I mean, there was aftermath for them. I mean, these kids got unwarranted attention. Mm-hmm. They would go to college games away, and people would show up with signs saying nappy-headed hoes. I mean, they were tormented, and for no fault of their own, just some mm-hmm. old, you know, white guy thinking he was being hip and cool and actually just saying something completely ludicrous and rude.
Now, you went to work for IMUS for how long?
I was there from 2007 to 2009.
Okay.
I was there for 2 out of 3
years.
Do you
talk about your experience with IMUS publicly?
I do.
It wasn't exactly the most pleasant.
It started off great. It started off wonderful. I was the golden child. I could do no wrong.
I thought you were brown.
Well, I was like more of a burnt sienna. but it was fantastic. I mean, I knew early on, after like first 6 weeks, that I was not dealing with a stable human being
mm-hmm.
Because I saw the way he treated other people. And it's almost like, you know, when you're dating someone and you see that they're really crappy to the waiter, you're like, okay, it's not going to be long before they're doing that to me too. But I held on as long as I could. And I took the job. I'll be honest. I took the job. Not because it was great money and it was an opportunity to further my career. Yes, that was always in the back of my head. Who wouldn't want to do that as a performer? But
right.
I had to decide, is this something morally that will work? And I remember thinking, if I don't do this, someone else will. And
did you get backlash from friends and family for taking the job?
You know, it's interesting. It was my family was torn. My mother was opposed and my father was like, you have to do this. You have to. And my father and I are the type of people that our definition of hell is if we don't try something, if we don't go for it, we're going to wander the rest of our lives. So why not?
Mm-hmm.
Right? But I also saw this as my opportunity. I went to school for journalism. I was supposed to be you.
You don't want to trust me.
I was going to.
I'm that rude guy to the waiter. I wasn't when I was much younger. I'm not rude now.
No,
I don't think.
I was going to be this beacon of light and truth. You know, I was going to get people to see what's really happening in the world. And I, you know, the journalism route didn't work out exactly the way I'd wanted. And so when I found comedy, that was the perfect combination of being able to still have fun, still have my voice, right, be uncensored, and get people to think and see things differently and create the mind shifts. So when I got to IMUS, I thought, here's my opportunity to be the anti-stereotype of what his audience probably thinks of black women, of women, period, and of black people. It's the perfect opportunity to you know, be this ingenue. You know, I mean, most of his audience are older, wealthy white men who had probably not had much interaction with young African American women unless they were assistants or they worked in their homes or, you know, not to stereotype, but let's be real.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is about being real.
When we talked about IMUS before we came on to the program, but I can remember years ago when I was in Cleveland, which, by the way, Cleveland was one of the best experiences I ever had. I loved the city because I changed and grew in ways that I never thought would be possible because people there are really patient and forgiving. But there was someone we all worked with, and I remember one day somebody saying, you know, he's a dick, but he's really a good guy. And I said, no, you can't be both. You can't be both. And people refer to Don when he was mm-hmm. here at Fox. They would mm-hmm. say, if he treats you badly, he likes you. And I would say, no, I don't think so.
No, if he treats you badly, he's a damaged person. Yeah. That's the answer.
The you know, I want to get back, though, to your experiences as a comedian because you talk about being the one person.
Mm-hmm.
Who get picked. When
mm-hmm.
I was a kid in elementary school, when they would do the Christmas show, you know, Coral Gables Elementary, I was always the Jew. You know, it's
Did
like, come talk
Joseph?
About Hanukkah.
Oh.
You know, and I went up there once. I think I was 10 years old and I'm in a kippah and you know, a talis. And I'm like, talking about Hanukkah in a Christmas pageant. And I'm like, you know, Hanukkah's not even really, oh, I'm going to get in trouble for this. It's about a military victory. It has nothing to do with forgiveness and the birth of a savior. That's not what I said at 10 years old. But so I've had that experience.
I thought you were going to say they put you as Joseph to make it really authentic.
You know, so it's when you talk about experience, you know, I think there are some people that white privilege. I keep going back to this thing, mm-hmm. because when I think about white privilege, I think about people, you know, uneducated, some people in Ohio, mm-hmm. in Cleveland, who are white and economically disadvantaged and really have very poor futures. And I don't see a whole lot of white privilege there. And then I think about, you know, when I first came out of school, I had a friend who's now a big venture capitalist in Chicago, and he's not a friend. Mm-hmm. But I remember him saying to me then, you know, you might want to consider a different career because, like you, I got a degree in journalism. And he said, because nobody wants to watch a Jew on TV. Oh. And I was like, whoa. But, you know, and it's so I think we also have to choose who we associate with.
Oh, absolutely. Without question. And when I talk about white privilege, it's not all economic, okay? It's mm-hmm. about, like I'm saying, what you see socially, what you see, the world you see around you, and what you see as considered acceptable and good, you know? So it's
acceptable
one of
those, and good.
Yeah.
So now I got to show you. I think I'm going to show you a photo. This is on, if you come to New York City, go to Fifth Avenue and roughly 53rd Street, five stories high. Is a Stuart, is it pronounced Weitzman? Is that the
I
store?
I think it's Weitzman.
Weitzman, Stuart
yeah,
Weitzman.
Stuart Weitzman.
Yeah. And it's an ad for shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows three incredibly good-looking naked women mm-hmm. embraced in what could only be called a threesome. And they are butt naked. You see everything except the front.
They got nothing but shoes on.
And nothing but shoes on. And I saw that, and I tweeted that picture out about a month and a half ago, and I said, what do you think they're selling? What do you think? That's the image. And one of them is black, one is Asian, and one is, I'm going to say white, but she might be Latino, Latina, Latinx, whatever mm-hmm. the proper term is today, because that's another issue. All these terms that keep changing.
Know.
I mean, my nephew said, I used the term Oriental one day, and my nephew, correct, right.
Yeah, because right. only vases and rugs are Oriental.
Right. So anyway, but you see this, and my cousin said, could you imagine if it was three guys? And I started laughing hysterically. I said, they should get like the three worst looking, out of shape guys, butt naked in boots, and put it up there and
that
see
would
what
be
happens.
Hysterical.
But what do you think
that
of that?
Really, listen. I worked at Estee Lauder for many, many years in corporate America, their headquarters. And being in entertainment, sex sells. That's why that's there. Sex sells.
But they're selling to women. Do you think women get into seeing three women in a threesome?
No. What they probably are saying, we want women to think is, oh, my God, my body looks terrible. I need to go to the gym. But you know what? I can't really do that. So let me buy
those
shoes.
Or they're selling a lot of shoes to guys who are not transgendered.
Exactly.
So I'm going to have to start wrapping up with you. And it's I was watching your – when I was preparing for the other interview and I was watching your clips, I was laughing and chuckling. And I was thinking to myself, I really want to get to know this woman. But – no. It's – you know, what advice – I'm going to ask you mm-hmm. an uncomfortable question. What advice would you give me as a white man mm-hmm. that you don't think I want to hear? And then what advice would you give a black person that you think they don't want to hear? And I'll keep my mouth shut while you're saying this.
As a white man, I think you probably don't want to hear how many advantages you actually have in this world. Whether you're Jewish or not, the fact that you actually have a penis gives you power in this country. More power than you may even be aware of because of the way society has set things up. Now, while you may not consider yourself you know, someone who's not, you may consider yourself a feminist. You may consider yourself very fair. There are things that I think happen on such a subconscious level, you don't even realize how good your life is. For black people, my advice would be, yes, things have been set up to be systematically racist. However, that does not define who you are or your abilities or your potential. Not every white person out there is out to get you. Not every white person out there has an agenda against you. Yes, there are things that are completely unfair, but you have to own your power. You have to own your greatness, and you have to take charge of that and do with your life what you will. And that means, you know, be strong in yourself, get educated, read, know what's happening in the world. And white people need to do the same thing. We need to know about each other. We are so into being separated and divided, and we think that that's okay. We can't operate like that any longer. We're doomed if we continue to do that. I am somebody who is very fortunate. I have had very few, if any, racist encounters. And I don't know if that's because I am who I am or how I see the world, but I have people do kind things for me all the time of all races, and I'm the same way. So maybe, you know, you are what you attract. And I think that's really the message for everybody. You know, who you are, you attract.
Kareth Foster's video clips, you can see them on YouTube, but where can people, they should meet you. More people need to meet you. Where can, starting in June, July, August, where can people see you? Because you lecture.
I do. I'm actually lecturing at Stanford University. I'm a guest lecturer there. I have these programs that I take to corporations and to colleges. So anyone can visit me on my website, kareth.com. That's K-A-R-I-T-H. I'm on Twitter. I do have a Facebook fan page that I'm working on. It's there, but it's probably easier to get me on my website. And I have my own YouTube channel, so I have some comedy clips on YouTube. And with, you know, hey, listen, I'm putting it out there. I'm gonna be on The View. I want to be the new co-host on The View.
You should be the new co-host on The View.
I should be.
All right. Well, you know, the 70s product in me, I feel like we, instead of playing the Talkonomics music, should be playing Marlo Thomas's Free to Be. I mean, how sugar gum liberal crap could that be? But the lyrics in that wouldn't be accepted today because it says any boy in this land can grow up to be his own man and be president. And it doesn't talk about the women doing that.
The women is cisgender.
Would you play that for your daughters?
Absolutely.
That song?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then you would point out, though, that a girl could be president.
Right. Absolutely. Of course I would.
All right. Kareth, it's great to see you.
Thank you so much.
Let me know what you think of the discussion we just had with Kareth Foster. And I'm going to try and get her back in the fall just to see how her career is going and how things have been progressing with her. I'm also going to invite her out to the terrace. I have this terrace on the 18th floor of the apartment building where I live, and it's great. And she'll start drinking wine again at some point, and I'm going to have her up there with her husband, and we're going to get rip-roaring. Can you say drunk on – I get the FCC won't get upset with that as long as they think we're not really drinking. We're going to get rip-roaring drunk. But send me the kinds of things you would like to hear us talk about on Talkonomics, and let me know what you think of the discussion we just had, what you liked, what you didn't like. You can find me at AJ Shapps on Twitter. Thanks for joining us today. Have a wonderful day.